greatest military alliance in the history of mankind, NATO, couldn't even help one country avoid being destroyed. And now that they've lost that one, you guys are literally the evidence of a paper tiger that you can't win anything. Are they thinking about that?
Yeah, no, I think they're already planning what to say once all of this goes south. And I think the most likely narrative you will see them falling back on is Russia attempted to wipe Ukraine off the map. They were going to take all of Ukraine. They were only able to end up with, what, 20%. So this was actually a defeat of Russia. They took a lot of casualties and they failed in their objective. So they're gonna have this. This will be the main victory narrative, which they will spin. But again, they haven't...
Well, but they can only say that if there is a negotiated settlement, which gives them more incentive to do it now so that they can claim that. But if they don't take this deal on the table here, then they're going to have to deal not with 20%, but with 40 or even more percent.
No, I agree. And this is why I think a negotiated settlement, even along bad terms, is better than a collapse. Because once the collapse comes, what benefit it gives to the Europeans is if there's a collapse, there's no peace agreement, then they can continue feeding Ukrainians into the meat grinder for years to come. They can just do some guerrilla warfare in the back. But if there's no peace agreement, then the Russians will seek security through territorial conquest. So then they will also take Kharkov, they will take Dnipro, they will take Nikolaev, they will take Odessa. So again, those four regions becomes eight, and they could also go further north. They even go after Kyiv. So Sumy, there's a lot of things they can do. But I think the Europeans are still holding on to this idea that if we can just keep the war going, some wonder weapon comes along, a bit more powerful sanction, we go after the Russian energy, just something might crack in Moscow. And in order to keep this going, the most important thing is obviously to get the Americans on board to commit to a forever war with the Russians as well. But this is why it's so strange that they're still going along with this, because because Ukraine now and NATO is losing not just on the battlefield, but the Ukrainian economy is falling apart. The political system is also beginning to unravel. As we see now with these corruption cases, they will begin to turn on each other. International support, of course, is also fading away. These leaders, we say the Europeans continue to fuel the war, but it's the political leadership. They're immensely unpopular. And we're building up our own legitimacy crisis among our political leadership. So I fully understand the American position. I mean, they initially, as you said, they just used Ukrainians, tried to weaken Russia, maybe even go for a regime change. And it didn't work. So now that a collapse is coming, what do? You hand it over to the Europeans and, claim to have made some money of it. You know, Russia's weakened, we sold some weapons, it's not our fault, we tried to make peace. Leave this with the Europeans. So this is also makes a lot of sense. But the European approach, as you see this disaster happening, as there's all the incentives in the world to find a political settlement, the goal is to keep this going. I know Europeans like Kallas keep saying, we want to strengthen Ukraine, to negotiate from a better position. Yeah, I don't really see it, because why? It would be more believable if they didn't boycott diplomacy. They don't talk to the Russians. Right. And they whenever they talk about peace in the next sentence, they talk about sending more weapons, pushing more sanctions, making Russia weaker, make them pay a price. I mean, they're looking for capitulation. They want victory. None of this is
all
peace.
And that's all aspirational. It's just like, boy, we cool if... Not there's any actionable plan that has a logical possibility of accomplishing it. So let me ask you the other half of that question. Forget about what the European leaders may want or what their aspirations are. What is your assessment as a European who's also aware of things in Asia and elsewhere in the world, in the event that this collapse scenario does happen, and regardless of whatever spin the West wants to put on it, when you have the smoldering wreckage of the Ukrainian armed forces, or maybe even the Kyiv, maybe the regime has fled, et cetera, and it's very clear that Russia has a military victory, whether that's a year from now, 3 years from now, whatever, what do you think is going to be the results, especially looking at the BRICS conglomerate? Because, you know, the people are going to be looking around the world where to put money that they feel is going to be secure and that people are acting rationally, et cetera, maybe in the global south. what impact might this have on people to see that NATO couldn't stop Ukraine from being destroyed?
Well, I think it's first important to know that that the Ukrainians themselves are building up some frustration and anger towards the Europeans, because they know that they've been used. Even when the Europeans are speaking very openly about why they're continuing to fuel the war, no one's really believing anymore that they can defeat the Russians unless there's a crack, as I mentioned before. But usually the rhetoric is around weakening Russia and buying ourselves some time. So when you have people like Arestovich, the former advisor of Zelensky, he argues that at some point Ukraine will want to have Zelensky, after he flees the country, delivered back in a cage. He also made the point that if he becomes president, the first thing he would do is go to Russia and promise that Ukraine will never again allow itself to be used as a threat against Russia. So I think that you could see a stabilization there between the Russians and the Ukrainians. But Europe, I think, has exhausted itself in the larger scheme of things. After World War II, of course, we hitched ourselves to the United States. The U.S. after World War II had some very generous trade agreements. We've been able to develop nicely, but at the moment, there's a multipolar system developing, and in this system, the Europeans aren't going to really have a central role because we cut ourselves off from the Russians. All that energy we got for cheap, all the huge markets, which the Russians favored the Europeans, all of this is gone. And then the Americans will also take their focus, their resources, priorities somewhere else. So it's a huge world emerging, and this is translating into actual economic interest. So the Russians will make sure that they will build up a powerful deterrent that will point to the West, towards Europe, and then all their economic connectivity will go to the East. So again, all that cheap energy, which was supposed to go to Europe, that's going to China now, to India. So the Asian economies will be even more competitive now, while the European economies go south. So there's it's very hard to see what kind of role the Europeans
will have. I understand you just got back from China, right? It was China?
Yeah, last night.
So what, to the extent that this came up in any of your conversations, how are they viewing this current situation where militarily Ukraine is just starting to collapse at an accelerating rate, and the Europeans stayed detached from reality on diplomacy? How's it being viewed over there?
Well, I think many see it as in the larger context of how the world is transforming into a more multipolar world. Because again, this was unthinkable only a few years ago. If you remember, in the 1990s, NATO's main relationship was with Russia was organized around the idea of managing Russia's perpetual decline. And now, of course, they see the political West with all its military might throwing all its all its weapons into this war, and they're being defeated by Russia. They're doing everything they can, putting all the sanctions they can, and still Russia's now the fourth largest economy in the world according to the World Bank, the largest one in Europe. I think they're seeing Russia as a key partner, preparing now to, well, essentially with China, help to drive forward this multipolar project, because even if Russia would want to work with the Europeans, they can't because of all the sanctions and the lack of trust. So they see Russia now as a driving force along with the Chinese to help to develop a new economic architecture based on new supply chains, new technological centers, industrial hubs, new transportation corridors through the Arctic. You have from Russia, Iran to India, also of course connecting closer with Northeast Asia. They see development of new development banks, trading in national currencies, moving away from SWIFT, because all this war is happening hand in hand with the economic warfare. So I think it's not the Europe's finest moment. I think a lot of the world,
Western world in large. For anybody who may not have seen it, I want to show some examples, because I've been using the term dysfunctional and lack of acknowledgement of reality, et cetera, coming from the European leaders. But lest anybody thinks that I'm exaggerating or making them look worse than they really are, I mean, there on your screen, you can see just a couple of days ago, on the 17th, you saw Macron was signing this deal for 100 fighter jets for Ukraine. Well, you know, in about 10 years. And by the way, they can't fly them right now. So you got to start that training process. That is going to have nothing to do with this current war. I mean, we already saw that when we tried to do it with the F-16s from the United States. But there they are, you know, glad-handed and happy, et cetera. And then now here, I think it was even earlier today, Kaya Kallas is aggravated about this peace plan because it doesn't demand enough concessions from Russia.
In order to end this war, you need the Ukrainians and the Europeans also to agree to those plans. So, of course, you know, Putin could end this war immediately if he just stopped bombing civilians and killing the people. But we haven't seen any concessions on the Russian side. We welcome all the meaningful efforts to end this war. But like we have said before, it has to be just and lasting. That also means that Ukrainians, but also Europeans, agreed to this.
So interesting how she emphasizes we're open to any meaningful concessions by the Russian side, et cetera. And that the only definition of that, correct me if you think I'm wrong, is that, yeah, if Russia capitulates and surrenders to us, then cool, we'll acknowledge that. Anything short of the concessions that the Europeans want, aside from what the battlefield will permit, that's what they're looking for. And if not, they want to keep pushing.
No, I agree. And I'll just like to say that she points out that Ukraine and the Europeans have to be included in this process. Well, I Ukrainian being, but first I thought it was given the proxy war and two main sides in this proxy war is the United States and Russia. I think it's important that these two great powers first come to an agreement based on the key issues, and then present it to Ukraine and hopefully take it on from there on. But there is no point to include the Europeans. Indeed, if I was advising the Ukrainians, I would say decouple quickly. They're not there to help you. They're there to continue to or keep the war going. They would like to see conscript some even younger Ukrainians to feed into this war. There's no proposal for peace. So why would the Americans or the Russians want to include the Europeans? It doesn't really make any sense. The only thing Kaya Kallas point to is, oh, if Russia really wanted to end the war, they could end it now, just stop fighting, have a ceasefire. But the only reason why we're even considering now accepting Ukraine's neutrality, ending NATO expansion, is because Russia's winning. If you have a ceasefire, the Europeans already said what they want to do. Oh, we can buy some time. We can produce more weapons. We can recruit more Ukrainians into the army. We can, feed some long-range missiles in there. We can prolong the war. This is what we're going for. There's a reason why we wouldn't discuss a ceasefire in the first 3 years of the war. But now that the whole thing is falling apart, now we want a ceasefire. We already played this game. That was the Minsk Agreement. Just freeze the front line and buy ourselves some time to build up a big army so we can go and kill some more Russians. We've done this before. No, so it's something easy talking points for the media, something to sell the idea that we're there to help Ukraine and Russia is evil and we just have to keep fighting. This is the path to peace.
And there was one more from that same press conference here where she was asked a little bit more about what the Russians could do and how they could bring this to an end, which she said, if all you got to do is agree to this unconditional ceasefire, and it'll be easy.
Of course, for any plan to work, it needs Ukrainians and Europeans on board. So this is very clear. Also, we have to understand that in this war, there is one aggressor and one victim. So we haven't heard of any concessions on the Russian side. I mean, if Russia really wanted peace, it could have, agreed to unconditional ceasefire already some time ago.
I'm sorry. I know you kind of addressed this a little bit, but I just cannot bring myself to understand how somebody who is at this high level, even with the hatred of Russia that she probably has from her nationalist days, I just don't see how you can make those kind of comments when you know that the the balance of power is so far out of whack against your side that to keep on this path here means that your objectives and your aspirations even are going to have the feet cut out from under them, and that the Ukraine side is just can't do anything except lose, whether they lose slowly or lose fastly. It's only between one of those two outcomes. I don't know. Redundant, I understand. How can this go on?
Well, they're not going to accept defeat, which is why you see this weird dynamic that the worst thing gets on the battlefield and is getting really bad now, the more the Europeans have to compensate with the rhetoric, which is why now the Germans are talking about long-range fire into Russia. This is why Macron is signing these deals of, as you said, some fighter jets, 10 years from now. You know, it's never going to materialize. But this is what they do. They beat their chest harder the more they're losing on the battlefield.
And I'm sorry, can you give us a little bit more information on this issue with the Germans from Chancellor Merz? What is it that he's actually offering?
Yeah, it's a bit vague. There hasn't been any commitment yet to the Taurus missiles, because if they come, there's a very good chance that Russia would retaliate directly against Germany. But there's a reason why they start to pledge long-range fire. That is, the Germans want to start striking deeper into Russia. And the reason for this is because the U.S. is pushing this peace plan now. So they have to find a way of balancing it. Because, again, if peace breaks out, then the party's over for these leaders. So... just another comment on Kaya Kallas, this idea of there's one victor, now there's one victim, there's one aggressor. It doesn't really make any sense at all. And again, the European leaders, as well as the United States, they're the one who backed and engineered the coup in 2014. We already know from the New York Times that on the first day after the coup that the US and the British began to work with the new intelligence services, which they helped install. They built it a new one from scratch to use it as a tool against the Russians. I mean, this is in the New York Times. We also know that they ignored and sabotaged the Minsk agreement for 7 years. They sabotaged the election results in 2019 when 73% of Ukrainians voted for peace platform. They rejected any of the real negotiations with the Russians in 2021. Again, the Istanbul Agreement was sabotaged in 2022, and for 3.5 years, they refused to talk to Russia. They said weapons are the path to peace. We are sending weapons, which are operated by Western contractors, to attack inside Russia. For God's sake, when we engineered or encouraged the Ukrainians to go invading Kursk, you had German generals on the army, German generals on the TV saying how wonderful this is, how this is going to cause a concern in Russia, because this is where German tanks were during World War II, and now they're back again. I mean, are we really going to go and pretend as if we're just standing on the sideline trying to help Ukraine? I mean, it's beyond absurd. I think this whole narrative of hers is falling apart very quickly. And the people who claimed moral authority for all of these years now, they're going to be exposed for ignoring all these casualties on the Ukrainian side. They just did anything they could to keep the war going. Because even now, you have a vast majority of Ukrainians who want an end to the war. They're ignoring all of them, and they're pretending to help Ukraine. So it's... No, it's theatrics, but it's coming to an end.
And speaking of ignoring battlefield reality, which we talked about here, I wonder if in the last bit of time we have here before we let you go, if you could talk about the economic realities that they also didn't talk about with these huge scandals of corruption that now have a number of high-ranking officials very close to Zelensky have actually fled the country and are under investigation for hundreds of millions and, in fact, in some cases, billions of dollars of corruption and stealing money. What is the story there?
Yeah, well, everyone knew that, again, the Ukraine was very corrupt. But once the Russians invaded, Ukraine had been transformed. Suddenly, there were no longer Nazis. Ever free leader pretending really corrupt all propaganda, but it is profoundly corrupt. But that has also worked to the Europeans' advantage, because if the Ukrainian public would decide, you know, they wouldn't have this military recruiters hunting down men on the street, dragging them out of their houses to send them to the trenches. You would have allowed men to actually leave the country. So you would have also had, with the vast majority of Ukrainians actually wanting an end to the war, you would have had negotiations. You wouldn't have a boycott of diplomacy. So all of this is, should have been obvious. So the corruption worked to the Europeans' advantage in terms of keeping the war going. But the government is now turning on itself. You see it imploding to some extent. And this is to a large extent because of the economic trouble and the corruption. I mean, the Ukrainian economy is on life support. They are now completely dependent on being financed from abroad, the people who are making their political decisions. So no, things are going very poor, and you see this also on the front line, as you also cover very well, the war of attrition. Now suddenly it's not so slow anymore because they can't hold the line. So the Russians are advancing faster and faster every day, which also means that with this fast advancements, they are also able to encircle thousands of troops, Ukrainian troops, which then have to surrender or die, usually the latter. And this only makes the manpower problem worse. So again, economically, corruption, military, across every measurable variable, things are going terribly wrong. And if you think you're going to get a horrible deal, worse deal tomorrow than you do today, then you sign that deal today. But right. The Europeans, they're living in the fantasy land. They're comparing the bad deal today with the ideal deal, which they make up in their own back room as they pat each other on the back. Russia just prepare, pull over, enjoy NATO. Oh, wonderful. Maybe we'll get Russia's natural resources. It's wonderful, but it doesn't. It belongs in La La Land. It's not real.
Yeah, it does. It would belong in a bad Hollywood movie because it would be so unrealistic. Yeah. No one would actually make that movie. But unfortunately, that's the reality that we have to navigate in. Well, listen, we're unintimidated and uncompromised to tell people the truth, whatever it is. And sometimes that's an unpleasant truth, like we're doing today. But it's something that people need to know. Because we don't need to be sending any more money, good money after bad. We don't need to keep going down a path that can't succeed, et cetera. And people need to know this. And so in that regard, we're very grateful for you coming on, your clarity with talking about these issues very much from the European perspective. Thank you for coming on.
Oh, anytime.
And there, as a reminder here, go to Glenn Deason on his YouTube channel, all kinds of things that are interesting there. And we will be looking for that ourselves. I actually look at that sometimes too. So thank you very much for that.
Thanks.
And we will be looking forward to seeing you. Listen, we got about 45 minutes or so from now, a show I promise you don't want to miss. And it's going to be Dr. John Gartner, who is an expert in the field of dementia and several other kinds of related medical issues here. And there is some serious information and evidence that President Trump is in fact suffering a cognitive decline. This is not a pejorative. This is not a trash Trump situation at all, but it is now hampering his decisions and his decision-making on issues on foreign policies and war-making issues that is very alarming. When you see what he has to say today, you're going to see this is a much more serious issue than you may have realized. That's going to be today at 3:15 p.m. on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.